Third Church of Christ Scientist, New York City, will now broadcast a lecture on Christian Science. In so doing, it warmly welcomes the radio audience, as well as all present here in the church edifice. The title of the lecture is Christian Science Reveals a New View of Man. William Milford Correll of Cleveland, Ohio, is the speaker. He comes to us as an authorized member of the Christian Science Board of Lectureship of the Mother Church, the first Church of Christ Scientist in Boston, Massachusetts. His subject tonight is a wonderful one, for he is going to tell you about the man you really are. The man God made in his own image and likeness. This may not be the view you have of yourself at the moment, but you can change this view, and the lecture will help you to do so. It is a pleasure now to introduce to you our speaker, Mr. Correll.
Thank you, Ms. Collins, and good evening, friends. I think that we'd all agree that these are very challenging times in which we live. Many of the accepted standards of thought and conduct are being radically changed. Now, in the face of this realignment of experience, I think that it is quite fitting for us to examine the basic premises of our existence. I'd like to pose a series of questions to you this evening, and then see if in the course of our reasoning together we can find the answers. The questions are these. Who are you? Where did you come from? What is your purpose or destiny? In other words, why do you exist? Now, the answers to these questions are very important to each one of us, for they indicate our knowledge of God and man. They relate directly to our sense of fulfillment, health, and well-being. And finally, they determine our actions in human society and our attitude toward our fellow man. It is of great moment to know oneself. And we shall see that self-knowledge leads to self-control and indeed to salvation from sin and mortality. And certainly this is the goal of all the earnest, prayerful efforts of mankind. In Christian Science, we learn that God alone creates and governs man, and that real self-control is God's harmonious government brought to light through prayer. If you look up at the heavens and behold the rhythm and order of the celestial universe, if you observe the exquisite beauty and color of a flower, hear the innocent laughter of children, and perhaps feel the warmth and joy of friendly companionship, you may well feel that you have glimpsed your heritage as the child of God. Good. The psalmist evidently took in such a view, for he said, "When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars, which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Thou madest him to have dominion over the works of thy hands. Thou hast put all things under his feet." But on the other hand, if you look down at the earth and see the mortality of all earthly things, the labor and poverty of mortal existence, the sin, sickness, and death, you might conclude that man is a clod, a mortal, a creation of the dust of the ground. Well, this lower view is also portrayed in the Bible, where it says in Job, "Man that is born of a woman is of few days and full of trouble." Now, which concept of man do you accept as true? In the Bible, in the first chapter of Genesis, where the spiritual record of creation is set forth, it is very clearly stated that man is made in the image and likeness of God. And Christian Science very logically teaches that it is only as we comprehend the nature of God that we can begin to understand man in God's likeness. This science is firmly based on the spiritual truths of life as set forth in the Holy Scriptures. Here we find God to be infinite good, pure spirit, the one great cause and creator of all that really exists. We can know him as divine love, the father and mother of man. We can know him as all powerful life and eternal truth. Well, now, this omnipotent and omnipresent God must be infinite. He must be everlasting. He must be perfect. Well, the real man then created in God's image and likeness must reflect this divine nature. He must be spiritual, upright, whole, sinless, perfect. Well, this is far different from the mortal material concept of man, created of the dust of the ground, and often considered as the miserable sinner. In the Christian Science textbook, Science and Health with Key to the Scriptures, Mary Baker Eddy, the discoverer and founder of Christian Science, has made this statement: "The divine nature was best expressed in Christ Jesus, who threw upon mortals the truer reflection of God and lifted their lives higher than their poor thought models would allow, thoughts which presented man as fallen, sick, sinning, and dying. The Christ-like understanding of scientific being and divine healing includes a perfect principle and idea, perfect God and perfect man as the basis of thought and demonstration." Now, Christian Science teaches that each one of us has that spiritual individuality which is the perfect likeness of God as his own true identity. And the working out of one's salvation is the process of realizing this perfect man as one's own true self and demonstrating this in daily experience. Now, this activity shows forth the practical healing effect of the Christ truth in our everyday living. For example, in the healing of sin, there's great need to restore one's self-respect. And this is done through lifting one's perception and gaining a higher concept of God and man. Now, a glimpse of this higher selfhood opens the way for the individual to bring out the qualities of God in his life. This is the process of regeneration. It is the individual's response to the Spirit of Truth, or Christ, and the identification of his thought and life with God. It says in Romans, "The Spirit itself beareth witness with our spirit that we are the children of God." Well, through repentance and quickened spiritual sense, one can prove the fact that he is upright, whole, and free, because that is the way God made him. Take, for example, the experience of the prodigal son as brought forth in Jesus' teachings. You'll recall that this younger son was given the portion of his father's goods that was his, and that he had gone into a far country and wasted it in riotous living. And then as the story goes on, there arose a mighty famine in that land, and he began to be in want. Then at the very depths of his sufferings, it says when he came to himself, he said, "How many hired servants of my father's have bread enough and to spare, and I perish with hunger?" Well, you know that he returned to his father's house, and that a wonderful welcome was waiting him there. His father said, "Let us eat and be merry, for this my son was dead and is alive again. He was lost and is found." In the Christian Science textbook, we have this statement: the real man, being linked by science to his Maker, mortals need only turn from sin and lose sight of mortal selfhood to find Christ, the real man, and his relation to God, and to recognize the divine sonship. Now, this is the theme for our lecture this evening: the correct view of man as the child of God, and the self-knowledge and self-control that come through the recognition of God and man as Father and Son, as cause and effect. Now, the awakening to this true view and relationship is the coming of Christ. And the coming of Christ results in healing of sickness and sin, sorrow and limitation, loneliness and discord. Here it might be well to explain briefly the distinction between Jesus and the Christ, as it is understood in Christian Science. The Christ is the divine nature of God, expressed in man. And Jesus was the highest human expression of this divine nature. The Christ is not limited to any period of time, for it is the ever-present idea of man's sonship with God, which Jesus so perfectly identified. Well, today this Christly nature reflected in man gives practical proof of healing in terms of better health, better morals, and greater freedom from lack and limitation. Now, there are many instances in the Bible where individuals have gained a glimpse of the coming of Christ and have found their relationship to God. Take, for example, the experience of Moses. When he was first called to lead the children of Israel out of Egypt, he responded in terms of a limited sense of himself. He said, "Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh, and that I should bring forth the children of Israel out of Egypt?" He was evidently thinking of himself as a mortal, having limited intelligence, limited ability, and quite inadequate for the task. Then, as he prayed over this message, the true nature of God as the one divine ego was revealed to him. God spoke to him and said, "I am that I am." Thus it was revealed that God is the mind or soul of man. In this conscious communion with God, Moses discovered his own unlimited capacities as God's reflection. He found the ego or father to be a continual presence with him, teaching him and leading him on to a higher, more Christly sense of being. Well, you'll recall other characters in the Bible. Jacob, when he struggled with a false sense of selfhood, and certainly Paul on the road to Damascus, when the Christ appeared to him. It says in our textbook, throughout all generations, both before and after the Christian era, the Christ as the spiritual idea, the reflection of God, has come with some measure of power and grace to all prepared to receive Christ's truth. Abraham, Jacob, Moses, and the prophets caught glorious glimpses of the Messiah, or Christ, which baptized these seers in the divine nature, the essence of love. Well, surely Jesus was the highest expression of the Christ, for he was able to prove the power of God perfectly in healing all manner of sickness and sin. Let me draw your attention to a case of remarkable transformation in this present era. Picture with me, if you will, a modest New England woman beset by misfortune and chronic ill health, separated from her loved ones and without visible means of support. In spite of her deeply religious nature and her hunger after spiritual things, her lot had been one of suffering and sorrow, lack and deprivation for much of the first half of her human experience. Then look with me again some years later, and you see an altogether different picture, a woman of radiant energy, realizing God's abundant goodness, loved and revered by thousands who have been healed and regenerated through her work. Her accomplishments have been stupendous. She has written a textbook of profound import, founded a religion, established a church, taught thousands of pupils, preached sermons, edited periodicals, and established an international daily newspaper. Now, all this was done in a period when women were not accepted in positions of leadership, and the opposition to this new discovery was intense and deeply entrenched. What brought about this immense change in the life of Mary Baker Eddy? It was the coming of Christ. Through her deep trials and spiritual research, through her having been healed of the effects of an accident, through spiritual means alone, she began to discern something of the nature of man, made in the image and likeness of God. She could see that this real man is sinless, and therefore not bound by any law of suffering. The great principle of Jesus' healing works became apparent. She says of this experience, "The divine hand led me into a new world of light and life, a fresh universe, old to God but new to his little one." Well, this new world is the spiritual sense of being, which dawns on the individual consciousness as the true nature of God and man is discerned. Now, many Christians emphasize the fact that in order to be saved, one must confess that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. Well, such a confession, spiritually understood, would recognize the eternal relation of God and man, which applies to all his children. Now, this relation is intact and continues throughout all time, for the Christ, as the spiritual idea of man's sonship with God, is not confined to any period of time, to any location, or to any person. In the Bible, Philip required such a confession of the eunuch. And Mrs. Eddy has discussed this in miscellaneous writings, where she says, Philip's requirement was that he should not only acknowledge the incarnation, God made manifest through man, but even the eternal relation of man and God, which applies to all his children. As the divine principle and spiritual idea. And she goes on to say, this is the Father's great love that he hath bestowed upon us. And it holds man in endless life and one eternal round of harmonious being. God is the creator of man. God is the creator of man. And man is the child of God, the offspring of spirit. All that we can ever know about man must come from God, spirit, the source of man's being. There's nothing to be learned from matter, which is the opposite of spirit. And yet, how zealous the search that goes on in looking into matter for the answer to this question, what is man? Mortal mind seeks for knowledge of man by dissecting a material body, by watching its symptoms, putting it under the microscope or the X-ray. Mortal mind pampers, fears, and bows down to a material body. Following the theory of heredity, biologists claim that all the characteristics of the individual are determined in terms of genes. The material genes transmitted through the material parents are said to be the determining factors in one's health, in one's appearance, and even in one's success or failure in life. Well, how does Christian Science answer this question? Where did you come from? Jesus answered it simply and precisely. He said, I came forth from the Father. All true manhood and womanhood come forth from God, and each one of us must echo Jesus' words, I came forth from the Father. What is it that determines your nature, your characteristics? What is it that outlines your destiny or success? It is God, Spirit, alone that creates and governs man. It is divine truth that determines your nature, your characteristics, your individuality. It is divine love that defines your being, outlines your activity, and unfolds the true identity of man. Well, learning the truth about heredity, that man is the child of God, is being born again in his likeness. It is putting off the old man and putting on the new. The Christ, as the true idea of God, must come to each one of us as his own divine nature. Now, this fact that man is the child of God, of the lineage of divine love, when seen to be the truth of our being, has a marked effect upon our thought about ourselves. This in turn determines how we act or express ourselves. Self-knowledge results in self-control. It says in the Bible, whosoever is born of God doth not commit sin, for his seed remaineth in him. And he cannot sin because he is born of God. The right idea of cause, source, origin has everything to do with the right idea of effect, manifestation, or man. What you are determines what you do. Have you ever heard someone justify a wrong action by saying, "Well, that's the way I am"? Have you ever heard that? Well, how important for this individual to know what he really is. Jesus was sure of his source and impulsion. He said, "I must work the works of him that sent me." And he taught us that what he did, we can do also. Now, the concept of man as a miserable sinner, a creation of the dust of the ground, would act as a millstone about the necks of those who accept it. But the idea of man as the child of God, the offspring of Spirit, has just the opposite liberating effect. It causes sin to drop away. It leaves the individual free from the slavery of wrong habits. We are not under any law of condemnation, for no such law exists in reality. And so we are not under any necessity of playing out the part of a suffering, sinning mortal. Christian Science has come to awaken us to this true view of man and to enable us to prove this in our daily experience. Now, how does this self-knowledge become practical to us? Let me tell you of an instance of healing to illustrate. A man was troubled with a chronic pulmonary condition, which had caused him to be in and out of hospitals for a number of years. Finally, he was without funds and without friends and even without hope. It was then that he first listened to one of the radio broadcasts in the series, How Christian Science Heals. The healing related in this broadcast was of a condition similar to his own. Well, naturally this quickened his interest, and he attended a Christian Science church service in the area where he lived, and also a lecture that was given in the same church. He was impressed with the facts of God and man that were presented. The revelation of God as divine love filled him with hope and expectancy. Well, he turned away from material methods of healing and began the earnest study of Christian Science, and soon sought the help of a Christian Science practitioner. Through this prayerful work and study, he began to discern something of the nature of man in the image and likeness of God. His own true spiritual identity became clearer to him as he pondered this particular passage from the Christian Science textbook. In science, man is the offspring of Spirit, the beautiful, good and pure constitute his ancestry. His origin is not like that of mortals in brute instinct, nor does he pass through material conditions prior to reaching intelligence. Spirit is his primitive and ultimate source of being. God is his Father, and life is the law of his being. Well, he was very soon completely healed, was able to return to his work. A physical examination in connection with this job confirmed his healing. Man is made up of the qualities of God. You can discern and reflect the qualities of love, truth, life, principle, mind, soul, spirit, and thus begin to define in your own life man in the likeness of God. This reminds me of a little story from a Sunday school class. A teacher observed one of her small pupils busy with a pad and a pencil. And she said, "Jimmy, what are you doing?" Well, Jimmy responded, "I'm drawing a picture of God." "Why, you can't do that. Nobody knows what God looks like." "Well," said Jimmy calmly, "they will when I get finished." That's confidence for you. Mrs. Eddy has said in her message to the Mother Church for 1901, "As Christian Scientists, you seek to define God to your own consciousness by feeling and applying the nature and practical possibilities of divine love. As God becomes known to you, your own sense of individuality becomes clearer, your actions more direct, and your life takes on meaning. This is the development of character, the discipline of thinking out from the standpoint of God as your source. This is the seed remaining in you, your heritage as the child of God. As mind's ideas, we have all the immortal elements of manhood, such as purity, continuity, indestructibility, goodness, wholeness, wisdom, love. Then as we live these qualities and know ourselves to be the ideas of God, the product of His wisdom, the object of His care, the expression of His law, then we shall echo the psalmist's self-recognition when he said, 'I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Marvelous are thy works, and that my soul knoweth right well.'" But with this proper recognition of man, we gain some measure of self-respect. Now, experience shows that self-respect tends to protect one from evil, while its opposite, self-depreciation, is the very open door to evil. Self-depreciation must be conquered in order to accomplish healing. It is mortal mind's view of man and includes all the elements of mortality. But how can anyone ever depreciate man, the perfect child of the Heavenly Father? If one is engaged in self-depreciation or self-pity, it is very obvious that his own thought model is wrong. Man is never a victim of circumstance. We should never cast ourselves in such a role or play the martyr. Man is the well-beloved of the Father, and no perversion of mortal thought can ever change that fact or cloud the blessings that God good has bestowed upon His beloved child. Now, if we would have the blessings, we must know ourselves as the children of God. Take, for example, the experience of the man at the pool of Bethesda. You'll recall that in the 5th chapter of John, it's recorded there that this man was one of a group of people gathered about this pool. And it was superstitiously felt that at a certain season an angel came down and troubled the waters, and then the first one to step in afterwards would be healed of his disease. But this man was impotent. He couldn't move. And every time the situation was favorable, somebody else stepped in before him. Well, can you imagine the self-pity, the frustration, and the resentment that must have been in this man's thought at what he considered to be his fate? Are there not many who have the experience of seeing others step in before them and in belief deprive them of a blessing? But is this possible in the science of being? No, emphatically not. Jesus, in healing this man, turned his thought away from the superstition of material remedy to the real source of healing, divine mind, which is unlimited and subject neither to chance nor to personal sense. There are no favorites in God's sight. His love is abundantly shed upon all his children. Now, this is a very important point to get a clear sense of the impartial nature of God's love. It's as all-embracing as the sunshine. Now, many fears and injustices and inequities are related to a limited personal sense of existence, a personal sense of supply of capacity. If we get the true idea of man as the reflection of God, we shall have one indestructible life, one infinite source of supply, one infinite mind or intelligence, which provides each one with unfailing happiness, harmony, capacity, supply. God good is omnipotent and omnipresent, and man is the immortal evidence of this presence. When we realize through prayer that the kingdom of heaven is actually within man, within true consciousness, then we will begin to demonstrate this fact through self-knowledge, through the knowledge of who and what we really are. The admonition in the Bible to go in and possess the land takes on additional meaning when we see that the land to be possessed is a true sense of selfhood as the child of God. Mrs. Eddy has said in miscellaneous writings, self-renunciation of all that constitutes a so-called material man and the acknowledgement and achievement of his spiritual identity as the child of God is science that opens the very floodgates of heaven, whence good flows into every avenue of being, cleansing mortals of all uncleanness, destroying all suffering, and demonstrating the true image and likeness. Jesus demonstrated this way of salvation. He was keenly aware of his sonship with God. In fact, he almost invariably referred to God as his Father. This sonship was his divine identity, and Jesus' conscious possession of it armed him against the attacks of evil. He consistently overcame evil with good, returned blessing for cursing, and brought healing and redemption to mankind, thus demonstrating the divine nature which animated him. It was his obedience to the will of God that determined Jesus' actions, outlined his identity, and guided his ministry. There is just one mind, one God, and the specific reason for man's being, man's existence, is to express that mind. So the will of God literally constitutes true manhood. And obedience to the will of God constitutes self-control. But we have in supposition an opposite to the will of God, which is called in the Bible the will of the flesh. Now the will of the flesh in belief constitutes the fleshly mortal, outlines his identity, and dictates his habits, tastes, and inclinations. It should be apparent to us that the will of the flesh, parading as a creator and expressed in pride, anger, lust, jealousy, malice, hate, causes the troubles and sufferings of mortals. Many of the restless frustrations of human experience stem from this false or mortal sense of will. It is only through the subduing of this will on the basis of its falsity that we can conquer the claims of the flesh, including sin, disease, and death. Let me tell you of a simple instance of healing and control that came into the experience of a young Christian Scientist. He was one of a group of acquaintances who were planning a social entertainment. Now, some of the members of this group were willfully determined to include drinking and the things that go with it. Well, in a few moments apart from the others, this young man sought the aid of divine mind to solve this seeming conflict. He began to refresh his thought about his relationship to God. He saw that above all human relations was that supreme obligation to divine truth and love, and that he must cling to that obligation first and fulfill it. Then he prayerfully sought to deny and destroy the beliefs of wrong attraction, and particularly the mesmerism of educated material custom. Well, when he returned to the group, new and improved plans had been proposed, more genuine joy and harmony were expressed, and the evening was spent in harmless entertainment. Now, it was apparent to this young man that this wasn't a case of domination through human will. It was the control of the divine mind, brought to light through prayer. How grateful he was that he could demonstrate self-control and not be helplessly entangled in mortal mind. Speaking of wrong influences, the disciple John has encouragingly written, "Ye are of God, little children, and have overcome them, because greater is he that is in you than he that is in the world." Jesus met and overcame the various forms of this fleshly will, externalized as sin, disease, malice, envy, hate. He destroyed these errors on the basis of the one mind, or spirit. His clear understanding of the allness of the divine mind and the omnipotence of the divine will resolved the foundations of these errors into their basic nothingness. He knew that there is no other mind but God. His clear perception of man as the child of God, forever one with the Father, liberated those whom he healed from the claims of matter or mortal will. Humility is the great antidote for this fleshly will. Humility is the great antidote for this fleshly will. When we see something of the frailty of mortal hopes, the inadequacy of material pleasures, and the elusiveness of happiness in matter, we will begin to recognize the fact that the belief of life and intelligence in matter is unreal. Now, this belief of selfhood in matter is the essence of error. And this is what needs to be denied and destroyed in science. Well, here's where the struggle occurs, and the battle between the fleshly sense and spirit is fought. It is pertinent that Jesus struggle in the Garden of Gethsemane at the threshold of his greatest demonstration, centered on overcoming the murderous human will with the divine. Now, if it was the crux of his problem then, can we doubt for a moment that it is an important element in the solving of all mortal difficulties? Mrs. Eddy has said in Unity of Good, the lust of the flesh and the pride of physical life must be quenched in the divine essence, that omnipotent love which annihilates hate, that life which knows no death. Well, today the claims of sin and corporeal sense are being increasingly accented in mortal thought. How are we to stay free from the enslaving enticements of wrong thought and the persistently aggressive theories of disease? All the temptations of evil relate to a false sense of self. It is by giving up this false self that we deprive error of an object or manifestation. We are assured in Christian Science that the Christ, as Jesus' true selfhood, never suffered. And it is equally true that our own true selfhood in Christ never suffers. Jesus provided the way out of suffering by laying down the mortal sense of man for the divine idea. Impersonalize this false self. See it as a lie about man, and you find out that it is nothing but mortal mind. The belief of life and intelligence in matter. Now, this is the false ego, the liar and the father of it. And this is what needs to be destroyed. Where is it destroyed? Right in your own thinking. The Bible tells us to deny self, take up the cross and follow in Jesus' footsteps. The human consciousness needs to be renovated, made free of all that pertains to a false sense of self, the self-will, the self-justification, the self-love. It is necessary to prayerfully reject the beliefs of sin and disease with a clear knowledge of their unreality, because they are not to be found in God or in God's man. Now, this burning of the tares, to use Jesus' parable, is a continuing operation until the utter nothingness of error is realized. Have you ever made a bonfire of trash, fired it, and left it to burn, thinking that all would be destroyed? And then perhaps later you've come back and stirred the ashes with a poker, and you found much there that remained intact. Well, it is this undestroyed remainder that needs to be fired again and again until nothing is left. Jesus said, "The prince of this world cometh and hath nothing in me." Can we say this? Well, when we can, we shall be free of the errors and discords of human life. Let me recall a statement that we quoted earlier from the Christian Science textbook. The real man, being linked by science to his maker, Mortals need only turn from sin and lose sight of mortal selfhood to find Christ, the real man in his relation to God, and to recognize the divine sonship. It might be well for us to take stock of how much time and attention is given to this material sense of selfhood during a single day, and then how much time and attention we give to the spiritual self during the same period. In this way, we can see if we are losing sight of mortal selfhood and gaining a clearer sense of the real man as God's image and likeness. For example, how much time do we spend in humble prayer, washing ourselves free of the impurities of worldliness? Do we clothe our idea of man in the robes of righteousness, peace, and purity? Do we feed our consciousness with the bread of heaven and the wine of inspiration? Do we frequently refresh ourselves with prayer at various intervals during the day? Well, just how much time and attention is given to this spiritualization of thought and life? Certainly, if we are to lose sight of mortal selfhood and find Christ, we must have an ever-increasing balance on the side of spirit. The grand necessity is to learn more about God. This results in true self-knowledge. Mrs. Eddy has said in Unity of Good, sooner or later the whole human race will learn that in proportion as the spotless selfhood of God is understood, human nature will be renovated, and man will receive a higher selfhood derived from God, and the redemption of mortals from sin, sickness, and death be established on everlasting foundations. All the harmony of God's law, the power and activity of truth, the loveliness of love, the beauty and grandeur of soul, the rhythm of spirit are expressed in man. We can see this man as the highest idea of God. And the dawning of this true idea of sonship is the coming of Christ. Now, when this idea occupies thought completely, then the mortal sense of existence will be swallowed up in immortality. But there are many intermediate steps, many healings, many redemptions along the way. It is necessary to learn this process of yielding the human to the divine in every way, even in the smallest details. We must silence the material senses, relinquish human outlining, and destroy false beliefs. The Christ as the true idea of man's sonship with God is available in every situation to heal the sick and redeem the sinner. There's always a way out. Jesus' compassionate ministry was to illustrate the ever-presence of the Christ. For he said, "Lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world." I once heard a testimony of a man who had a personal sense of hatred to overcome. His antagonist seemed to present an insurmountable barrier to his peace of mind and body. Well, he talked over his problem with a Christian Science practitioner, And in the course of their discussion and reasoning together, he was told to cling to this phrase from one of Mrs. Eddy's poems whenever he met this individual. Thou gentle beam of living love. Well, he agreed to correct his thought about man, and whenever he met this individual, or even thought about him, he clung steadfastly to that idea. Thou gentle beam of living love. Well, of course it wasn't long until the mesmerism of hatred was completely broken. He found his freedom of mind and body, and he had gained a friend. Well, what can we say about our purpose or destiny? The basic purpose of man is to express God. This is his reason for being. As the nature of God becomes clearer to us, then the reason for our existence will become clearer. The Bible portrays this divine nature in a variety of ways. The idea of God as the father-mother includes the tender love and care for his children. The idea of God as shepherd includes comforting his flock, seeking out the lost sheep, and guiding and guarding the little ones. The idea of God as the great healer of all our diseases is clearly set forth. The idea of God as the supplier of all good included feeding the multitude, providing water and manna for the Israelites, and caring for the widow of Zarephath. Now, all these various expressions define the nature of God and give us a clear insight into the nature of man. Jesus defined the will of God as the will of love, the will of truth, the will of life. He came to heal, to redeem, to uplift the downtrodden. He said, I am come that they might have life, and that they might have it more abundantly. Well, as our example, Jesus came to prove the fact that the Christ is the divine nature, the spiritual selfhood of every man. The Christ is here. The true idea of man's sonship with God is available to all, and it heals. Now, how does this apply to you and to me individually? It says in the Bible, as many as received him, to them gave he power to become the sons of God, even to them that believe on his name, which were born not of blood, nor of the will of the flesh, nor of the will of man, but of God. As many as receive this true idea of man's sonship with God may prove the power of God to heal and to save. They may experience all the blessings that a loving father bestows upon his children. Now, is this coming of Christ some spectacular event? No, it's a quiet affair. This is a subjective experience. It comes in the innermost precincts of sacred prayer. Consider how it came to Moses, to Jacob, and to the prodigal. It says in one of the hymns in our Christian Science hymnal, the Christ, eternal manhood, as God's own Son beloved, a tender, ever presence within each heart is proved. Well, with this coming of Christ is naturally accompanied by healing and regeneration, by an awakening joy and gratitude for the goodness of God. For with this idea of sonship comes the fact that man is the heir of God and joint heir with Christ, and a clear sense that all that the Father has is ours. Now let us see if we have answered the questions that we posed earlier in the lecture. Who are you? Where did you come from? Why do you exist? A clear sense that man is the child of God establishes our spiritual status, our self-respect, our health and well-being on everlasting foundations. The great fact that man comes forth from the Father as deity's self-expression defines the nature of man as the compound idea of God, the expression of love, the activity of divine principle. The purpose of man's being is to manifest the nature of God, to express the wisdom, the purity, the holiness of true being. Well, as the what, where, and why of our existence becomes clearer to us, then we are manifesting that self-knowledge which leads to self-control and hence to salvation, or oneness with our divine source. Now, this whole subject is cogently summarized in the passage from 1 John, which is a regular part of our Sunday service. It is pertinent that Mrs. Eddy included this as an important element in our worship. Behold what manner of love the Father hath bestowed upon us, that we should be called the sons of God. Therefore the world knoweth us not, because it knew him not. Beloved, now are we the sons of God, and it doth not yet appear what we shall be. But we know that when he shall appear, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. And every man that hath this hope in him purifieth himself, even as he is pure. Good evening.
You have just listened to a Christian Science lecture from Third Church of Christ Scientist of New York City. If you